Trundled on through.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Let's go back just a little bit. You said you were Swiss. You were a Swiss national living in Germany. And you saw the rise of Hitler's Nazi Party.
Oh, yes.
Why? Was there never any kind of acknowledgement that you were not a German and therefore there were certain conventions which had to be applied to non-German nationals? Because you suffered from quite a few SS searches over the time.
Yeah, but that didn't happen until the war started. Before the war, I was all right, except that I didn't join the Hitler Youth, because all children at the age of 10 had to join the Hitler Youth, and I didn't, because I wasn't German. I could have done, but my father wouldn't let me because he said, no, we're Swiss and you're not going to join.
Which explains the comment that Hitler made when you stumbled in front of his motor car. Why aren't you wearing a uniform?
Yes, well, that was a little accident meeting Hitler, wasn't it?
Is it very clearly imprinted in your mind, actually, meeting him? And how old were you at the time?
14.
Is it still very clearly imprinted?
Oh, yes. I don't think you ever forget that. I think probably also because I always talked about it. That was something I even told my children about because they were fascinated with that. Come and tell us again what happened when you met Hitler, because this was harmless.
Yes.
I just didn't talk about the time when I was a refugee. But having met Hitler, that in a way they thought it was fun, although to me it wasn't, because it was frightening from the point of view that partly I was thinking, what would my parents say, because they weren't for Hitler, they were against him. Mm. And also, it was something so unusual when it did happen, because it was really an accident.
And he got your flowers, which were meant for your father.
Yes, that's quite true. So I just sort of said that, but I don't think he ever heard that, because people shout so much and screamed, and I don't think he realised what I was saying. And of course the SS always gets you awake very quickly. They don't let you talk very long to the Führer, you see. But of course the next day when I came to school, all my school friends teased me about it. They kept on saying, well, that is rather peculiar, you know, you meeting Hitler and giving him flowers, and you're not even in the Hitler Youth, and we who like him and adore him, you know, we didn't have the chance.
You must have been asked this question countless times, but it is a fascinating subject, because there aren't too many people around these days that you come across in everyday English life that who have met Hitler. What was your impression of him? Was he frightening? Was he just a person? Was he domineering? Was he magnetic?
Yes, he was. He had very cold eyes. That's something I do remember. Although he smiled, but to me, even as a child, I could feel there was no warmth in it. This was just a smile so that everybody could see, look, he's a friendly man. But his eyes were cold, and it's sort of, I was frightened at the moment. So probably I imagined more than there was there, but no, his eyes were cold. There was no friendliness there at all.
Yeah. The story of the early part of the war years is not an uncommon story. A lot of people encountered the same kind of things that you did. But what was fascinating for me in reading the book was what constitutes the significant part of it, which is your refugee flight away from Germany. Now, for a start, you were 20 years old. You're a medical student. You were suddenly thrust into something which I very much doubt if that many young people these days could even cope with. Did it ever occur to you during the course of from the start of your flight onwards, before you even started looking for your family, that this was something that you'd never cope with, that somehow you shouldn't be in this position?
No, I don't think that occurred to me, because everybody else around me in the refugee track was in the same position. I think the only thing that kept me going was, I'm not going to die. I'm going. And however cold it was, because, I mean, we had 10, 15 degrees below zero, and, I mean, you could never take your clothes off. You had no warmth, no shelter or anything. You just stumble along and you go. And if you see people dead by the side, all I could think of was, that's not going to be me. And you just keep on going.
You were surrounded by death, destruction, despair, cold, hunger, every kind of deprivation that you could think of. And in the book, you've not really avoided it. I get the suspicion that perhaps it's not quite as harsh as it really was, as written, because, you know, some things you just can't write about which people would understand. But in writing it, was it a painful exercise? I know you said your children persuaded you eventually to talk about it.
Well, it was very hard to write about the worst part in the book, because I got cold again, and I got hungry again, and And I kept on saying to myself, it's all right, now I'm not cold anymore. But I still started shivering, and even whilst I was writing it, you go through it again, and this is why I never wanted to talk about it. But having written about it once, well, I can talk now.
Is it still painful to talk about it, though? I mean, you don't seem to be. You're sort of, we're sitting here quite happily, but somewhere I detect your eyes, there's a little bit of a...
I still feel cold when I think of the real harder times, but one can, in thought, push things away.
Yes.
And I'm very good at that. I had to learn that, because even when I was a refugee and stumbled along, I wouldn't think of maybe anything that tastes very good to eat or so. You must avoid thinking of those things. The best thing is only to think of just the next moment and keep going.
Mm.
Of course, I had one thing. My mother gave me some poison. She gave me some cyanide. I had it in a very small phial round my neck, and it became eventually my talisman.
Mm.
I used to, if I was absolutely desperate and I didn't know what to do, I used to just touch it, and I used to feel it, and I used to think, well, it's there. I can finish it if I want to. And I think that helped me.
That was a sort of prop for you.
It was. Even in later years, when I didn't have it anymore, if there was something, I used to be inclined to put my...
your hand to where it should have been.
Yes.
Did you ever really think that you would be able to use it, though? Even though it was there?
Yes, I did. Oh, yes, I did. Especially, I wrote about it in the book called The Village of Hell.
Mm.
I can't talk about it, but I did write because I felt people ought to know.
Yes.
And after having seen that, I think I would have been able to take it.
Yes. Now, The Village of Hell is something else. I mean, that is, it's incomprehensible. And that constitutes not a large part of Helga, but it's... I can't imagine it. I really cannot imagine what it was like. And for a 20-year-old to see that kind of thing, do you feel scarred by all this?
I had a good life after that. Well, it took a long time, actually. Even when we went back to Switzerland, it wasn't easy, but... once I got married, I had a good life after that, and I think it covered it up.
Mm.
I didn't bring it back for a long time until I wrote the book again. I tried to forget it.
It's been almost like a self-immolation exercise writing this, hasn't it? Not only to sort of get it out of your system, because eventually you're persuaded to, but also, as you've just said, to relive what went on. And it's masochism, isn't it, in a large part of the way? It's because of the pain of the memories.
I don't think it does any harm, because I feel it does come out then, once and for all. And like I said, it's good to tell the story.
You feel better for it?
Yes, and I think people ought to know about it, because like you mentioned before, particularly in England, people don't know what happened in the East.
No.
They only know what happened in the West because of the Allied forces and the Normandy landings. But nobody left in Germany when the Americans and the English came. They just waited for them, and they were glad that the war was finished.
Mm.
But when the Russians came near to us, they all left, thousands and thousands of people. And some tried to get out by boat, and I mean, they got shot at, and the boat sank. It was just a mass of people trying to get out in this terrible winter.
And yet there were high points of almost uncharacteristic kindness. I mean, I'm thinking of the incident with Max.
Oh, yes.
Now Max was a one-armed man, as you said in the book.
Mm.
You tried to persuade people to get him on the lorry because he was wounded, he was sick, and he'd given his arm for the fatherland. And somehow or other, you know, it was a persuasion, but underneath it was... okay, fine, we're all brothers together.
Yes, well, he did get away in the end, and I think that was good. I was lucky to find these two people, really, so that we could join together. But this is what happened. People sort of tried to get together. If there was a family, of course, they had their tracks, and I mean, there was a wagon and horses, and the children were in the back, and maybe old granny and so on. That was fine, but if you didn't have that, you just had to walk and try and maybe find somebody with whom you could join up, because that was better. Because even at night, if you sleep on snow, it's better if three or four, you know, huddle together, because you get some kind of warmth then.
Yeah.
So I was lucky to find those two people who also did not take advantage of my young years, because that could have happened too, couldn't it?
But that's one of I find an amazing thing, is that out of all this carnage and out of the... well, I suppose the complete collapse, moral collapse of society at that time particularly, that at the end of the day you were always respected.
The Germans are very correct.
Mm.
They really are very correct. And yes, I was respected, I must say. Probably I didn't get into a crowd. I've got into the right crowd of people.
Yes.
Maybe there are others too, particularly in the refugee camps, and I always avoided those. I didn't like them.
Mm. You've lived, at that time, you lived with all kinds of deprivation and death. Has it ever changed your attitude towards death? I mean, does that mean anything to you now? Because you've seen so much at a tender age.
I think I recognise death quicker than other people probably would. I'm very sympathetic to people who are ill and know that they might die, because I know what death is like.
Yes. But does it mean anything to you now? Because, you know, you see somebody fall through the ice, for example, and you just left them because, apart from the fact they're probably instantly dead anyway, you could die yourself trying to rescue them. So
yes, you become very cruel.
Yes.
And hard. But that wears off. I mean, that's worn off by now, I should think. But in those days, I needed it. I wouldn't have survived. I wouldn't have survived if I hadn't been hard. You just have to be hard then, like you said. Mm. Once you break into the ice, even if you try to help pulling a person out, you might have fallen in yourself. And
That was it. Pointless exercise, wasn't it?
Yes, yes, yes.
You were reduced to eating bark at one point, weren't you? I mean, this is part of the fact that when you finally collapsed.
I only ate it because Max said, I must have something in my stomach to get it working, because I didn't really feel hungry. Mm. That is the funny part about it. You know, you come to a stage where you don't feel the hunger anymore. It's gone. Mm. But you feel weak because there's nothing there. And he said, the stomach must work. Now, come on then. And he cut off the black part, you see, and gave me the white. But I wrote in the book, that's the same. All I remember about that part is that my teeth hurt because it was so hard.
Yes.
I know we can laugh about it today, but it wasn't a
none of this was funny at the time.
No, but looking back, one or two things I can laugh about, you know, what we've done, even when I jumped onto the train and this sort of thing, you can laugh about it today. But, well, I was very scared at the time.
But you did it nevertheless, because you have to.
Well, you had to. You see, if you have no choice, there's only just the one thing. You take potluck. You just do it.
Yes.
You just do it. And I did it. And I had, of course, I had quite a bit of luck too.
Well, I don't know. I think one engineers one's luck. I think it's positive, probably a positive nature and a positive attitude that gets people through more than luck. However, I mean, that's just a personal opinion. One of the other parts, which is the to my mind, again, almost incomprehensible, is the decision to search for your family. I mean, I wouldn't know where to start in the complete chaos that existed.
Well, we did insofar. Once I found my mother, and I had to go and look for my father. Well, the nearest big town was Hamburg, and we knew there was a Red Cross station where you could go and register, and they would then exchange the addresses with other towns and so on. So that was the first thing to do. So I did that, and of course, it was like a miracle that I found my father.
Yes.
But after that, you see, I had one sister who was near Munich in Mainburg, and that I knew was occupied by the American forces. Now, she wouldn't have left, so I had her address. I knew where she lived. It was only a matter of getting there, but we had, after the war in Germany, no post, no trains, and you weren't supposed to move from one occupation part to the other one. We had the English, the French, the Americans, and of course in the East the Russians, right, but of course nobody went to the East. They were all trying to get out.
Yes.
So it was a matter of moving, and I'm afraid I had to do a little bit of lying, because I could not admit that I'd already found my parents when I started on this journey. I pretended I was looking for all of them. So I was able to move from the English zone into the American zone. Otherwise I wouldn't have been permitted to do this.
I'm sure that's a lie which is totally forgivable.
I'm sure it is. Yes.
But you eventually did reunite, with your family.
Yes.
I can't imagine what sort of reunion that was, except that it was probably one of the most emotional times of your life.
Well, it was very, very emotional, yes. But you see, I only brought two sisters back. My brother was then still missing, and we lived under very primitive circumstances, just on this old radio station.
Yeah.
We only Well, the water was a well. The toilet was a little shed in the back with a bucket, you see, sort of.
Yes.
Really very primitive. But my brother did find us through the Red Cross in Hamburg.
Mm.
Just the same as I had wanted to find my brother, my father.
I don't think people appreciate even now the tremendous work that the Red Cross did do.
No, I don't think they know about it very much.
No.
But they were also very good during the war because, you know, where I lived, not far from us on the farm, we had French prisoners of war, and they used to get food parcels through the Red Cross and letters through the Red Cross from France, because, you see, the war against France was soon finished, and then we had the Russian war after that.
Yeah.
So, of course, the French prisoners of war weren't allowed to go back.
Mm.
So they were still there. But there, through the Red Cross, they used to get letters, and like I said, and food parcels.
Let's just very briefly dwell on the subject of the Russians. They are undoubtedly, as you said, one of the cruelest people, certainly around about that time, and for a little while afterwards, you know, if you look at the history. And the things that they did was revenge. I mean, there's no other word for it. It was barbaric revenge, both on innocent people as well as German soldiers. Why do you think, having gone through that, that the other Allied powers, America, France, England, were frightened of them? They were only a quarter of the occupation forces, and yet everybody bowed down and kowtowed to everything that they demanded. Why? I mean, did you get any insight, because you were there?
Well, I wonder whether they knew about it, but couldn't admit it, because they were allies, weren't they?
Well,
you can't very well.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I'm not sure whether they, again, knew about it, because, you see, when the war was finished, or let's say just before it was finished, the Germans tried to make a peace treaty, but wanted to not be involved with the Russians.
Mm.
They tried to do it only with the Americans and the English, and they wouldn't accept it. They said, look, we're all in the war. And this is what the German generals said. They said, we cannot let our soldiers be taken now by the Russians, because we know that they will never come back.
Mm.
And it's true. I mean, I've had school friends in Germany, and they've had their relatives or brother or father coming back 2 or 3 years after the war.
Mm.
Because they were imprisoned in Russia, and when they came back, they died.
Yes.
They were only sent back because they weren't healthy enough.
Yes.
But hardly anybody came back.
What's your attitude towards Russians nowadays? I mean,
well, I still don't like them. I don't think I ever will, because I lived in Königsberg, which now is still Russian, although the eastern part of Germany is united with the West. But Königsberg, the Russians kept, and they made it into a harbour. Because being so near the Baltic, it's the only harbour they have in the winter which doesn't freeze up.
Right, yes.
Well, that's, although I was Swiss, but that was my home.
Mm.
I've never been back. We lost everything.
Yes.
You can't love people who have taken everything from you, can you?
I ask the question, I make no judgment on that one. From your own point of view, have you actually ever retraced any of the route that you took when you were fleeing as a refugee?
No, but I have found some of my old school friends again.
Oh, lovely.
Yes, through one school friend, she had started to collect sort of addresses and names, and she gradually got nearly our whole class together, and then she found me, and I've been back to Germany, and I've met her and some of the others too, and I'm at least in contact with people I went to school with, which was rather nice.
Yes.
To hear their stories again.
Yes.
And to tell them my story and make comparisons.
Mm. And it's one heck of a story as far as I'm concerned. I mean, we've chatted, and I've deliberately not gone into details in the book, because I don't think that a quick chat like this could do it any justice. It's something that has to be sit down and read 2 or 3 times to absorb the sheer horror of everything that you went through. And you were just one. I mean, again, I'm not degrading this in any way, but you were one out of tens of thousands of people. And it's the one voice which you've actually sat down and said, look, people should know about this.
Well, I'll tell you something. What happened is I started to get fan mail, and one woman wrote to me in German, and she said, I'm so glad you wrote this story, because she married an English soldier just after the war and came to England, and she started to tell people about what happened to her, because she had a similar experience, and they didn't believe her, so she didn't mention it again. And she said, now, with you having written this book, I'm so glad, and I tell my friends now, go and buy that book and read it, and you know I spoke the truth.
And they can understand a little bit more, although understand I use with a small u, because I don't think anybody, unless they went through it, could actually understand.
No, I don't think so, but they probably sympathise, and they ought to know what has happened.
Which do you prefer, sympathy or understanding?
Understanding. I don't want sympathy. No, but I want them to understand so that it won't happen again. Because I know the soldiers suffer, but the civilians in the last war have suffered too. So they have in England with all the bombing and all the rest of it.
It's the innocent who always suffer
the wars.
Yes. I've always said that if you send the politicians to fight the wars, we wouldn't have any wars.
Oh, you're quite right. You're quite right.
But that's utopia. Helga, many thanks indeed for coming in. The book is it's a nice book. It's got its little points of humour, but for me it's an overriding horror, because I don't understand it in its full sense, because I never experienced it. And with the greatest of respect, I would never want to experience it. I don't think anybody should do, but now you've done it, at least it shows that there is another side to a story which is going to go on for a long, long time. The book is called Simply Helga. It's published by Verona. It's £6.99, and it is, it's about 400 pages long. I know it was edited down from about 800 pages. Perhaps there's another volume coming out very soon. Helga Gahardy, thank you very much indeed for coming and chatting to us about it.
Thank you.
Out. And then in 1944, when the Russians break through the German front on the Eastern German front, what happened to you then?
Well, once they came near to Königsberg, the wounded soldiers kept on telling us, particularly the young nurses, we ought to try and get out, because they had experienced what the Russians were like, because some of the parts which the Russians had already occupied, they reconquered, and they could see what cruelties they had inflicted on the civilian population. And they warned us and said we ought to try and get out. But there was no proper evacuation procedure at all, because the news we heard on the wireless all the time was that the German army are holding the Russians back. But we did, when we started to inquire from the wounded soldiers, know that this wasn't the truth. So I'm afraid I just had to leave too. And at that particular moment, my whole family was scattered. My mother was evacuated, and so was my brother with his school. And my father didn't have his business in Königsberg. And my other two sisters were also somewhere else. So I decided to start off on my own and just joined one of the refugee tracks to try and get out. I just packed up and got as many warm clothes on as I possibly could, and I had a satchel over my shoulder with some money, and I took a sleigh where I put a suitcase on and had a rucksack, and I just started to walk.
Did you fear for your life?
I did not fear for my life. I think I was more afraid from the Russians. I had heard too many stories, and I was fortunate, or maybe you can call it unfortunate. My mother had given me a small phial with cyanide, which I carried around my neck, and it became a kind of talisman. And whenever the Russians, whilst I was a refugee, whenever they came too near, I used to touch it, and I used to think, what if they really turn up suddenly? That's what I can do. I can just take the poison.
Can you look back on that time now, Helga, or has it taken a long time for you to come to terms with what happened to you? And, I mean, you were extremely young, only 19 or 20.
I couldn't talk about it for years, and even my children, when they asked me about it, I never would mention anything about the time when I was a refugee. I would tell them about what Hitler was like and how I met him and what it was like to be at school. But this part I never touched. And it was actually my eldest son, Victor, who said to me one day, if you could write it, then you will find you are able to talk about it, and we would like to know, even if you don't talk about it. And that made me decide to start, and I started to write. But when I came to the, so I decided I might as well start right from the beginning, you know, what it was like to go to school under Hitler and so on. But then when I came to the part where I was a refugee,
I had all sorts of excuses why I couldn't carry on with writing. I even did a bit of housework and sort of said, no, I haven't got the time for it. But eventually I did, and I'm afraid I sort of went through it all again. I was cold again, and I was hungry again. But I did put a lot of it down into the book, not all of it, because some of it was too horrible to even write about it. And when it was finished, this is what the family felt. They felt it was a story which should be told, because the what happened to the civilian population in the East was bad, and a lot of people in England don't really know what happened. You see, when the Americans and English entered Germany from the West, I mean from France, no German left. They all stayed where they were, and a lot of them were glad the war was finished. But in the East, everybody that could only walk or move left, because we all knew what would happen. And even today, if you look at Königsberg, it's still Russian, and no Germans are living there. The Russians, well, they got rid of them all. Either they took them to Siberia, or they just told them to go.
That is super, Helga. That was exactly what I wanted. Thank you very much indeed. I'm very grateful. Just stop your...